Welcome to the Mergers and Acquisitions podcast. Over the past 16 episodes, we've covered many aspects of the M&A trade. But there's an unexplored territory to be covered before we close out the second season of the podcast, and that is joint ventures. When and why do JVs work, and when not? I have the perfect guest to discuss this subject, and I welcome Michael O'Dwyer. Michael is Global Co-Head of Energy Investment Banking at Morgan Stanley. And over the years, we've been working together on quite a few different projects. And if I recall correctly, Michael, fortunately, always on the same side of the negotiating table. Michael, welcome to the show, and thanks for coming to the studio.
Many thanks, Koos, and it's a real pleasure to take part. I found your series to be really interesting and informative, so it's a real pleasure to be asked to contribute.
And my starting question, tell me something about one of the most interesting deals you've worked on. What was the situation like, and what did you learn from it?
And it's a question that I'm often asked by people who are looking to come into the world of investment banking. And I always say the same thing. It would have been the sale of the Mažeikių nafta refinery in Lithuania, which was one of the first deals that I led back in around 2005 when I was a relatively junior banker. Not the biggest deal, not the highest profile deal, but in many ways, the most fascinating one. Just to give some backdrop, I was advising Yukos, the now defunct Russian oil company, which owned a 54% share in the Mažeikių nafta refinery, and the minority shareholder was the Lithuanian state. And Yukos had recently been put into bankruptcy in Russia and needed to sell assets in order to satisfy creditors. So there was already a lot of pressure on the process, and it was already complex to begin with. But adding to that, then the Lithuanian authorities wanted to ensure that whomever acquired the Mažeikių nafta refinery and acquired Yukos stake would be a reputable buyer, acceptable to the Lithuanian state, but also someone who would potentially acquire their stake at an attractive price. And so we had interest from a wide range of players, but namely Russian downstream players, who obviously saw this as an important beachhead into the Central and Eastern European markets. And then on the other side, Central and Eastern European players who were looking to acquire the asset as a defensive maneuver to protect their markets potentially from Russian competition coming in with cheap crude and cheap products. And then, of course, there was the Russian bankruptcy agency who were looking to ensure that any proceeds from a sale would find their way back to Russia to satisfy creditors there. And so it was a fascinating, really, and sometimes daunting experience with many, many twists and turns. And I think probably the most valuable lesson from it was understanding the interests of each party involved in a complex transaction. It's not just about the shareholders or the seller or the buyers. It's about the broader stakeholders. And that can be regulators, creditors, competitors. And you need to ensure that you understand their motivations and objectives. In the end, PKN Orlen from Poland was the winning bidder and acquired ultimately the entirety of the business, including the Lithuanian state's sale, their stake. However, it was somewhat of a bittersweet victory for them because several months after the deal completed, the pipeline feeding the refinery from Russia was shut down, forcing the company to source crude from other jurisdictions at higher prices and making the economics far more challenging. And so in the end, it was successful from one perspective, from a defensive perspective, but ultimately commercially quite a difficult transaction for them. And in the end, they wrote off quite a lot of the value in the following years.
Thank you, Michael. That's a great example. And we'll get back later about the complexities of joint ventures, as you've already given a good introduction. And your reference to the stakeholder interest in sense of your biggest learning would be perfect as an example of the 3D negotiation analysis that David Lex from Harvard Negotiation Project described to us in a previous episode. So if we stay with negotiations, if you would be planning for a complex negotiation, as you just described, what would be the 3 bits of advice that you would give our listener?
Well, I think firstly, defining success is critical. Understanding what your limits are. You must have a preferred outcome, but you may also need to have an acceptable outcome. So you need to have a range into which you can fit a solution. And remember, negotiations are rarely, if ever, a zero-sum game. I think the second point is, on a tactical level, knowing who's in the room with whom you're going to be negotiating. Understand their role in the organization, understanding the hierarchy in the organization, and try to work out what their objectives are going to be. And then finally, I think planning your tactics and strategy in the meeting. Who will lead from your side? Who will talk? Who will supplement? Who is ready to cover issue A or issue B? And what are your arguments supporting your position? and what are the counter arguments that you can expect to be used against you. And sometimes it makes sense to game out a negotiation in advance, you know, the so-called blue team, red team approach. But either way, I think it's important preparation is the key for any negotiation.
I've done those sort of game playing exercises beforehand. So now we're in the negotiation room. What further advice do you have for us once you're there?
I think this may sound a little funny to say, but remaining calm. I think you bear in mind negotiations can take hours, days, weeks, even months, and tensions can run high, fatigue can set in. So remaining calm, things can get emotional, but it's very important to stay calm and not to take things personally. I also think you hear people sometimes talk about someone not negotiating in good faith. And in my experience over the last 20, 30 years, it's rarely the case that somebody is not acting in good faith. But there are many situations which are caused by either miscommunication, cultural differences, differing negotiation styles, or lack of authority on the other side, where someone commits to something but doesn't have the authority to deliver.
So it feels like it wasn't good faith, but it wasn't really.
Exactly. It feels bad to the if you're the on the other side, but if you understand the motivations and the drivers of the other counterparty, you begin to understand that someone is doing their best to try and come to a solution. And in fact, I like looking across the room as people, really as my peers. They've also come to the table to do a deal as you have. So it's really important that you try and find a common ground with them. I think the more tactically, I think, again, listening and watching are really as important as speaking, looking for body language cues that may tell you something may be important or maybe more agreeable or less agreeable to the counterparty. As with anything in life, body language can be very important. I think more specifically, though, and we've seen this, frankly, even in recent days in some of the things we're seeing in the geopolitical space, understanding the value of a give and don't give something away cheaply. Always try and get something in return. And I think we often see situations where people give up something which is perceived as an easy give, but frankly, it may be important to the other side and may have given them a very significant value, which otherwise may have given you something for. And I would say the last point is use space, use breakouts. It's very, very useful to regroup and reset your strategy and your tactics when you're in a very heated and very lengthy negotiation.
Yes, I would like the breakouts because it would always give me a chance to ask my team members to share what they've observed and get their views on the next steps to take. So given that you have the banking background, of course, I think the following question is very relevant. How do you keep track of value during the negotiation?
It's a really good point because a specific number is really only as good as the assumptions that underlie it. And so one of the things that it's very important to establish up front is what assumptions, what definitions are being used by a bidder to arrive at a valuation. For instance, what is the effective date of the valuation? What is the treatment of working capital? What is the treatment of dividends between signing and closing? All of these are actual important value drivers. And so it's very important to understand as clearly as possible what the basis for someone's value is. Ultimately, you need to track value and you need to track the give and takes of any transaction. You need to compare your own value, of course, to the BATNA or the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. And if ultimately the value that you're looking at and the value that you can calculate is being offered by the bidder falls below your BATNA, well, then you don't have a deal. So it's important to ensure that you're attributing value not just to the financial points, but also to the non-financial points in any negotiation.
Yes, we would try to translate these elements that are not in the headline price to an NPV and net present value because there could also be supply contracts or transition service contracts with value. And you've got, of course, your positive and negative synergies. And even the indemnities that you provide or ask for will have a value.
Yes, that's right. And that's why when I think you design a bidding process, bids can become very difficult to compare. So trying to make a bid format as specific as possible is something that we do. So really ask people to almost fill in the blanks of a bid in order to arrive at a very accurate reflection of what the underlying value is to me as a seller.
But my experience was when I'm a bidder, you feel a bit like you're forced into a straitjacket. And if you want to be creative and you have value options, how would you then deal with that?
No, that's absolutely a valid point. And I think as a bidder, I think first and foremost, you should try to conform to the requests of the seller, but also feel free to add on top of that, if you have creative solutions or alternative solutions, I think it's very important for a bidder to see those or for a seller to see those. And so I, yes, would certainly encourage it, but I think it's very important from a seller's perspective to ensure that you are lining people up on the same basis.
Thanks, Michael. And before we go into joint ventures, we'll take a short break to hear from our sponsor, Pilco.
Pilco & Associates is the leading advisor to deal leaders and senior executives on operational EHS and ESG risks and liabilities in the global chemical and energy industries. With 45 years of experience, the firm has advised on more than $600 billion worth of transactions involving facilities in 80 countries, including some of the highest profile deals spanning those five decades. Pilco's advisors have an average of 38 years of relevant professional experience in operational and executive roles with major energy and chemical companies. For more information, go to pilco.com.
Hello, you're back in the M&A podcast with my guest Michael O'Dwyer from Morgan Stanley. Let's now go back into joint ventures. And I've sometimes thought to myself that JVs are great for business professionals in M&A, as many of the joint ventures don't last forever and things can become very complex on dissolution, or even if just one party wants to sell its share.
Well, I couldn't possibly comment, obviously, that JVs are good for investment bankers, but I think it is true that you do need an exit mechanism. I think it's better for each party to be comfortable that at a certain moment, if you want to exit, you can exit the venture. Of course, the bar needs to be high to allow somebody to leave a joint venture. In my experience, JVs that have clear exit mechanisms tend to lead to better strategic partnerships, reduces uncertainty and conflict, encourages commitment, and it facilitates strategic flexibility for the partner and ultimately protects value.
I can align with that, Michael, as I experienced in one of the first joint ventures I negotiated, that we were overly focused on having certainty that the joint venture would last. And therefore, there was a lack of exit mechanisms. When business circumstances then changed, it was in our interest to terminate, and it turned out to be too difficult. So let's say I want to sell my shares in a joint venture. The other party doesn't. So just in the example that I gave at the beginning, how do you go about it?
So I think you may want to maximize your ability to sell your share in a competitive process. However, if there is a right of first refusal, as we've seen in a number of scenarios, in other words, where one of the parties to the JV has the right to match an offer from a third party or a so-called ROFR, then there is a risk of parties not participating in an auction because they view the likelihood that the ROFR will be exercised as high and all of their efforts will have been in vain. And so they may not even participate.
So how would you address that, Michael, up front? Would you then be better off not incorporating a ROFR but only a ROFO, which would be your right of first offer, in your joint venture agreement?
Yes, that's one way to do it, obviously. A ROFO where the partner has the right to make a preemptive offer can often be a better option. But it requires the potential seller to make an assessment on whether the offer is good enough, rather than doing a so-called market test. It can obviously be beneficial in allowing you to do a quick deal, but it may not necessarily maximize value for you. And if you think you can get a better price through an auction, you can get the parties to the table easier as there is no ROFR on the table. The partner, so to speak, has already had its chance. But the risk, of course, is if you don't get to success in the auction, you may have to revert to that partner. And of course, the offer that they may have placed at the outset may no longer be available to you. And the other option, if there is a ROFR, is to offer bidders some form of cost reimbursal in case the rights are exercised by the bidder. So you lower the opportunity cost to them participating.
And if you would be the joint venture partner, like in your very first example, the Lithuanian government, and you want to exercise more control on who your future partner is going to be in case of a sale, how would you do that?
Yes, it's not always easy. One thing that you can do, for instance, is to control the rights on sharing information on the joint venture itself. For example, you can stipulate in the original joint venture agreement that information can only be shared with those companies who are not competitors or are not desired by the partner for a variety of reasons. You also have change of control clauses, of course, that may impact the ability to sell the stake.
And are they very common in our business?
They are. We see them sometimes, not always, but they can act, of course, as a poison pill, and so a protection against ending up with a joint venture partner that you did not choose. But of course, it can be a big issue for smaller companies that they may lose their ability to control their old destiny. For a bigger company, it may not matter as much if a small stake in a joint venture is preempted by somebody or the change of control clause is triggered. But for smaller companies, it can be a very big deal.
Yeah. And what else should we keep in mind when we're setting up the joint venture?
Well, look, I think it's quite a lengthy checklist, starting with what the overarching objective of the joint venture is. What assets are you contributing? What is the business plan? What's the envisioned legal structure? Is it a contractual arrangement or is it a newly incorporated company? The former, of course, is easier to undo, but perhaps less effective at extracting full value from. Then, of course, you have the financial aspects. How do you agree on the value of your respective contributions, assets, or technologies? You need to agree on the capital distribution policy and dividends. One shareholder, for instance, may prefer reinvestment into the business. Another may prefer cash and dividends for their other plans for other businesses. And that may also have an impact on capital structure. Do you want a debt-free joint venture, or do you want to have its own ability to raise its own capital? And last, but by no means least, I think governance. Who controls the company? Is the chair or the CEO of the company going to be appointed by one of the parties, or will it be independent? How do you manage dispute resolution? And frankly, that's one of the most critical items when you are setting up a joint venture, is to have a clear and effective dispute resolution mechanism in place. And of course, if and when one party wants to exit, how do you structure that in advance?
That's quite a list indeed. So if you go through your decades of experience, what have you seen where joint ventures work best and create the most value for the shareholders?
Well, I think for starters, well-structured joint ventures with clear governance arrangements have a better chance of success. More generally, though, I think that when the objectives of the shareholders are aligned from the outset, for example, two parties see an activity as non-core, yet want to remain exposed to it, but need to reduce cost. And we're seeing this in action in the UK North Sea even today. Shell and Equinor recently combining their North Sea assets, Eni and Ithaca combining their North Sea assets. And frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of these because the interests of the parties are very much aligned in trying to run their businesses more efficiently. The other successful joint ventures that we see are ones where each party brings something unique yet complementary to the venture. And that enables, for instance, access to customers or technologies, for instance. And a good example of that would be one which I'm sure, Hoos, you're very familiar with, is Raízen, the Shell Cosan joint venture in Brazil, where Cosan contributed its sugarcane ethanol business and Shell contributed its distribution network. And it was a real win-win for each party.
Yeah, and there you could say there's also a cultural match in the sense that we got the local expertise from Cosan, the partner, and the international ability of a larger company like Shell. So indeed, there's a good complementary action there. Michael, in this season of the podcast, I've also tried to learn more about dealing in cross-cultural settings. So I would like to ask you about the complex deal you've worked on cross-culturally, and where was that important to get right?
So one of the nice things about working in the energy sector, of course, is that almost every strategic transaction involves a cross-border element. So dealing with different cultures and different styles is really part and parcel of the job. And I'll be a little bit cheeky here by saying probably the transaction that I remember most fondly from a cultural perspective was with Hughes. And that was on the sale of Shell's interest in Showa Shell back in 2014 and 2015. And I think it's really important in negotiations to understand nuance in different cultures. And John Abbott alluded to this in one of your earlier shows. In certain cultures, for instance, there may be a tendency to prefer to avoid a hard no and instead use softer phrasing, which has the potential, of course, for misinterpretation. Similarly, punctuality may have a greater or lesser importance, so one needs to be alert to that. More importantly, I think, however, certain cultures foster more hierarchical decision-making versus collaborative decision-making, and knowing which is favored by your counterparty may influence how you negotiate and with whom you focus your negotiations. As I said, if I had to pick a single transaction where those approaches were most evident, it was on the sale of Shell's interest in Showa Shell back in 2014-15. And as you will recall, Showa Shell was both a listed entity and a joint venture entity with Saudi Aramco. So really complex just from the outset. Also, we were working with an entirely Japanese group of counterparties with some still very conservative approaches. And don't forget, unsolicited or unfriendly M&A was a somewhat unknown concept in Japan until relatively recently. And there was resistance from various camps to the envisaged transaction. We had to be extremely careful in our preparation, understanding all of the parties' drivers and different negotiation styles. And I would say in that transaction, more than any other transaction I've done in the last 30 years, I relied on the advice of my local colleagues and took their lead on how best to navigate the local politics, but also how to present ideas, structures, understand the dynamics on the other side of the table. So it truly was fascinating, but a very challenging transaction.
Well, it's been described to me as only the second ever hostile deal done in Japan, in the sense that the outcome was not the preferred outcome for the local management team. I remember that one factor was also important, which was to understand the regulatory environment and the soft power of the regulators, which is very different to many of the Western countries that we deal in, who were promoting a consolidation of the industry. And that helped to support the deal eventually. Well, thank you, Michael. That brings back great memories, and I've enjoyed reliving them with you. And I would also like to thank you for sharing your wisdom on negotiations and the complex subject of joint ventures.
It's been a real pleasure and also brought back many fond memories for me likewise.
And that brings us to the end of this podcast and also to the end of this season. We'll take a break now, but deal making is a very wide subject with lots of skills and knowledge required to navigate through them as well as possible. That's why there's always a different aspect to cover. And so together with our sponsor Pilco, I hope to be back with you in the future. Thank you for listening.